Hi there, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's Earth Day.
Yeah, and the date?
April 22nd.
I knew you'd forget. Yes,
yeah, 2018. Mm-hmm. Happy Earth Day to you.
Happy Earth Day.
And to celebrate that,
we have guests.
We have two of our earthier people.
That's true.
Here, Sadie Abuhoff and Dixon Cuff.
Friends of the Earth.
All right.
And we have a special high concept podcast today. We are going to talk quite a bit about My Fair Lady, which is a show that all four of us saw yesterday. That's true. All four of us saw
the Lerner and Lowe musical that's being revived.
Mm-hmm. On Broadway in New York
City.
Lincoln Center. But
back to the news.
But I just want to say we're going to spend a lot of time on that. But first, we're going to cover a few other things. But stay tuned for the My Fair Lady discussion. Now, go.
Okay. Lydia Bastianich.
That's right.
Has done a memoir.
She does. She has.
It's called My American Dream.
And Lydia Bastianich is?
Well, she's a restaurateur. I mean, we love her.
Yeah.
We just love her. She's had a show on PBS about cooking. She's probably done a million other...
And what's her Broadway restaurant again that we go to?
Philidia.
No, the one, the Broadway restaurant.
Oh, the Broadway. Becco?
Becco. We go to. I know we've been there with Dixon recently. You've gone too, haven't you, Sadie, or not?
Could be.
Oh, yeah. Italian restaurant. Great restaurant, right?
I liked it.
Yeah, super.
Well, so anyway...
There's a great story.
Review of her book, mm-hmm. her memoir, mm-hmm. by Moira Hodgson in the Wall Street Journal. And it's a great story. Mm-hmm. She grew up actually in the city of Pola.
Yeah, it's an Italian city taken over by Tito.
Yes. Right?
Yeah.
The region, Italy ceded the region to Yugoslavia in 1947, just about when she was born.
Right.
And they have a tough life there.
They have a totalitarian
regime. In fact, Tito's guys haul her... father into jail, mm-hmm. for no particular reason. At a certain point, the secret police come and take her dad away. He's in jail for 30 days.
So they have to get out of there.
On suspicion, right. of being a capitalist.
Right. Well,
they have a tough life. They manage to escape to Trieste under the guise of visiting a sick brother or something like that. Actually, her father will have to follow later. And they end up in a refugee camp in San Saba, formerly a Nazi concentration camp. This is in the 50s, 1956. And also a rice mill. It's got 2,000 refugees in there. Life is tough. We were forced to fend for ourselves. Ms. Bastianich writes, "It was a period of near terror that I will never be able to forget, no matter how much I want to." Eventually, she's allowed to help out, to go to a Catholic school, nearby Catholic school, and help out in the kitchen, where she learns how to cook quantity. Eventually, they make it to America, and they're provided with a place to live and a little bit of furniture and clothing and food. They open up the box of food. There's this one container of something called Crisco. They can't really figure out what it is. Her mother tastes it and she says, "Aha, it's floor wax."
And what Lydia said? Lydia says, "We tasted it and it was right. It was floor wax." But, of course, it wasn't. But it was Crisco. That was her impression of Crisco.
We got it, Dan. We got it. Moving right along here. And this is where she develops a great taste for Spam,
right.
Wonder Bread, American cheese. But anyway, she grows up. She goes to Hunter College. She works part-time at restaurants. She works part-time at a bakery, the Walken Bakery.
Right.
Where the son of the owners, Christopher Walken, does the deliveries.
That's right.
Yes, and it is the Christopher Walken.
Right. His father owns the place.
Eventually she marries Mr. Bastianich. They end up with restaurants in Queens. And their flagship ends up being Philidia. And now she has a bunch of restaurants with a variety of partners, including her own son. And also several of the... she's involved in the Italy, mm-hmm. Establishments as well. Anyway, it's a great story of refugee coming to America and finding her dream and working it out.
Yeah, so, anyway, it's kind of amazing that she has such modest background and such a harrowing escape, and then she's got all these restaurants and she's a zillionaire, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of weird. It's hard to believe.
Kind of the polar opposite of last week's domestic goddess, Nigella.
Well, not the polar opposite. She's successful.
But she kind of... entirely different kind of person.
Financed in a different way. Yes.
Moving right along.
Big week in terms of Superman. It was the 80th anniversary and the 1000th edition of Superman comics. Superman is 80, sort of. And you say to yourself, well, does that really play into the way he looks and feels? And the answer is he sort of does and sort of doesn't, depending on who's writing it and what period of time it is.
Can I just point something out really quick?
Sure, absolutely.
I think this is a conspiracy on the part of DC Comics because Avengers Infinity War is coming out next week and they're just trying to steal the spotlight.
Well, of course that's true. They're doing anything for publicity. Nothing could be clearer about that.
I think DC is a dying brand. And they're just trying to keep it alive.
I don't know if they're a dying brand. You know, I don't know about their dying brand. But in any event, the story of comics is about really inventing and reinventing the character, all for the purpose of trying to get some kind of headline and some kind of attention. So it's what you're talking about. And nothing could be clearer proof than what the Times gives us.
I thought he died.
See, there you go. Now, here's the problem. Here's the problem. He did. And then
wait a minute, Superman died?
No. Yeah. Oh. Every 10 years, as the Times proves by having some select covers over the last 80 years, something cataclysmic happens to Superman, and then they don't worry about it, and they start again. So he starts out...
And they don't have to resolve it.
Yeah, he starts out...
That's
well,
like the Roseanne. They don't say it was just a dream.
Like the Roseanne reboot.
And it's perhaps a little more dramatic. Let me demonstrate. So he starts out, innocently enough, in 1938. He's doing things like picking up cars that are in accidents on the Long Island Expressway, which is impressive, but somewhat limited in terms of its appeal on the effect.
How does he have anything else to do?
Well, one comic. But in any event, yes, the LIE can keep you busy. And he's keeping busy like this for a while, although comics apparently declined during the war. People don't have a taste for comics after the war. And even it's not until the late 40s or early 50s that people are willing to get back into that kind of fantasy mode. And that's when Superman starts really doing well. And they broaden his horizons, and he's doing things like going to the North Pole, and he has his Fortress of Solitude, and he's got all these villains he has to deal with, which are also supervillains, so they're kind of in their heyday then. And then around 1960, they start asking questions like you did, Tams, at the beginning, like saying, isn't he older? And they feel compelled to do a series about Superman with gray hair, sitting down with Lois, saying, isn't it too bad we never got married, looking up and seeing Supergirl take care of things. He's older. They have to deal with reality.
But do you really want him to be mortal like that?
You don't. No, then you forget about that.
No, no.
And then 10 years later, he just looks the same way he's always looked. He's back. He's looking 38 years old or something like that, or 35 years old, whatever it is. And they have some, but they run a whole other series.
It's all about the Botox.
It's about apocalyptic. You can't puncture his skin with a needle, Tamsin.
Oh, you can't?
No. So, in any event...
Cryogenics?
No, do you want to listen and learn here?
All right.
Okay. So, in any event, they have run some series about he ends up going into exile because he feels he was morally compromised. We don't get that. But that, that doesn't stick either. 10 years later...
This is back to the thing about him not marrying...
My point is, it changes every 10 years.
Okay. All right.
That's the whole point.
All right.
10 years later, he's back, and they say, you know something? This idea about Superman being born on Krypton and his secret identity Clark Kent, it's really the other way. He's born on the Earth. His secret identity is Superman. That seems odd. But it gives him something to write about for 5 or 10 years.
That's too much for me to handle.
It is. And then they get back, and they say, forget about that. And then they get back to normal, and they say, well, this is boring. So now they have Superman marrying Lois Lane.
No longer morally compromised.
The moral compromise had nothing to do with that kind of thing anyway. So in any event, they have a picture of him showing Lois, that he's Superman, and he does this effectively by...
Wait a minute, they can do that in the comics?
They can, because he takes his glasses off.
Oh, now I get it.
And she is so stunned by that. So stunned by that, that she says, the engagement's off. I have to process this. And she says literally to him, as she seeks to be by herself, when you go, Superman, don't forget to lock the door or a window. You know, because she's flummoxed. She thought the Clark was earthbound. So in any event, she eventually gets her mind to wrap around it and they get married. And then it's time for another reboot. So now it's new, younger Superman. And here's the big deal, and this is in 2011. They get rid of the red trunks. Superman's got a one-piece suit, all blue, no red undies on top of it. Right?
Yeah.
Okay? That's the
So
big...
he basically looks like a loser.
I don't know
get
what
it?
That means. No.
A loser. Guys, we're
yeah.
later.
He does look like a loser, right? That's interesting, yeah. So in any event, they do that for a while. And then 2018, they celebrate 1,000. How they celebrate 1,000? What's the big event?
Gives him his underwear back.
Exactly right. Yeah. So now he's back.
I thought he was getting divorced.
No, he's not. No longer.
Morally
he's back with Lois. He looks great. Look at that with the red undies, as Tamsin described. Mm-hmm. He's never looked better, really.
It's really important to have those for the waist definition. Otherwise, it just you lose it.
Yeah, yeah.
They're figure flattering.
Yes.
They look good.
I agree, absolutely. And if you look at, videos and things from the Olympics, from the Winter Olympics, you will agree too.
All right.
Yeah, that's what you're missing with the luge uniform.
So he's back. He's back in business. So, good. We had a great story
Speaking
about
of flying.
Speaking of flying.
Yeah. Review in the Wall Street Journal of The Feather Thief. A book by Kirk Wallace Johnson.
This was crazy.
This
crazy
was really crazy.
Crazy story.
Okay. So in the Natural History Museum in Tring, Hertfordshire, a place like northwest of London, there's one of the greatest collections of ornithological specimens on the planet. Lots of bird stuff. Okay. Including finches gathered by Charles Darwin. Colorful birds brought back by Darwin's contemporary, the naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, etc. I mean, it's amazing, iconic stuff.
Right.
On a June evening in 2009, a 20-year-old American flutist named Edwin Rist broke into the museum and started stuffing a suitcase full of all this stuff. Okay.
Feathers.
And
he stole feathers, basically.
Flawless, unreplaceable specimens.
Right. And he gets away with it. And he gets he stuffs his bag full of feathers. He walks out.
He's there for 3 hours.
Right.
And he steals hundreds of these.
And they start showing up on the black market. He's selling them. And people use the feathers for a few different reasons, some for ornamental, but some for fly fishing. Feathers are very much prized for fly fishing. Right. And this guy's making a living fly fishing.
And they have a whole mystique around them.
And
the theft goes unnoticed.
They don't care.
For a month.
The police don't care.
And it takes them a year and a half to track him down. And then the judge is convinced by an expert's opinion that he suffers from Asperger's.
Well, wait a second. Yeah, but first they arrest him.
He gets a suspended sentence.
Right. They arrest him. He doesn't even care. He says, yeah, sure, I did that. What's the problem?
Yeah.
I took the feathers.
He confesses immediately.
And then they say he's got Asperger's. It's tough to get off on Asperger's. I didn't know that was a defense. And
it is for stealing feathers, apparently.
Yeah, it is.
And the author interviews him, and he says he has no remorse. He doesn't even feel like a thief. He kind of... it's really the museum's fault for not having
not better
security.
Yeah.
Oh okay. So anyway, so this book is about the theft. It's about naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, and what we don't know about him in terms of, collecting these exotic specimens. In Victorian times, people were really crazed about birds and really crazed about feathers because of women's hats. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know about the British and their hats.
Oh, yeah.
And,
fascinating.
And then it also is, this book is the story of this guy who is basically a... what you might call him a refugee advocate. He was involved in a nonprofit helping Iraqi refugees.
Well, but that's the guy who did the investigation. That's
who
the guy who stole the feathers. So the guy who did
the guy who wrote the book.
The guy wrote the book, right.
He's on a fly fishing trip and hears about this story, gets obsessed.
He needs a break from the refugee business. So he decides to track this down and write this crazy book. So that's his name. He's
Kirk Wallace Johnson.
Johnson, yeah.
Okay, The Feather Thief.
All right.
And this is reviewed by somebody named Tom Nolan. He says it's a great book. It's worth reading. So if you're interested in
feathers.
And theft.
And ecology, really. It's an Earth Day story.
And Victorian naturalists.
Yeah, okay. Going down the list. The
Beach Book.
Beach Book, yeah. So the Knicks and the Nets, you're asking yourself, which is going to be the better team? Which team is on the rise? Which is going to be, because they both stink. This is basketball.
I don't see how they can be on the rise.
Well,
either of them, really.
They can't get worse, so that's by definition they're on the rise.
But you say that every year, I think, and every year they get worse.
Well, let me speak and I'll tell you what's going to happen.
All right, we'll see.
The story is they interviewed a bunch of people. Can we, let me go back to Let Me Speak and we'll see what we can talk about here.
Just on the subject of, you know, who gets better. And
struggling.
You know,
right. So the deal was this, that the short answer is the Nets are going to get better before the Knicks are going to get better. And there are...
Wait a minute. The who's?
The Nets.
The Nets are getting better?
Yes.
Before the Knicks?
Yes.
And the Knicks just fired their coach,
okay.
Right?
So let me play this out, okay?
Yeah, I'm just trying to help you.
Okay. So the Nets are going to get better. And the reason that the Nets are going to get better are four. There are four reasons. The first is the Nets have a coach. That's the first reason.
Do we like him?
Yes. A fellow named Kenny Atkinson. The Knicks do not have a coach.
All right.
So that's step one. All right. The second is that the Nets have ownership problem that's going to resolve itself. They have this Russian owner, but he's selling his large interest in the Nets. The Knicks still have the Dolans, who are a little bit spotty in terms of the ownership area. The Nets are under the radar. Everyone watches everything the Knicks do. They don't watch everything the Nets do. Nobody cares what the Nets do.
And why does that help them get better?
Because if you lose, you get a better draft choice. There's no pressure, right? And finally, the Nets have a better arena, according to everybody. The Barclays Arena is considered a top arena. Mm-hmm. And the Knicks have the Garden, which is no longer considered a top arena, and that's a big deal in this business. The teams that get better have the better arenas. So I'm hearing your only negativity about the Nets, but I'm telling everybody now, it's the Nets, not the Knicks, that are going to be the team in New York. Okay? Just so you know.
Okay, we're holding you to that.
Good.
Speaking of New York.
Yes.
Nice obituary this week. I mean, a little shout out to Barbara Bush.
Right.
Who passed away this week. And it turns out to be, I think, quite a pip.
Yes.
I really enjoyed seeing clips from her various interviews. She was what she was.
Right.
But meanwhile, saw another obituary of a woman named Jean McFadden, who in the headline was the master of holiday spectacle and the Macy's parade. And so she was a woman who she was born in Texas, and she had an education to be in theater. And somehow she ends up getting involved with putting on shows, all right? Well, putting on festivals is not so different from putting on theater productions, I guess. And from 1977 on, she's involved with Macy's. And at that time in the 70s, things like the Macy's Parade, you know, and all were kind of on the wane. And you remember being at the Macy's Parade.
I don't remember
in the 70s.
As clearly as you do, but I think you're probably right. We were discussing this, and you said that they're a much bigger deal now than they were then. I think that's probably right.
Yeah. I mean, you remember wandering down to watch them blow up the balloons the night before.
Yes.
There were like five of us there. And now you have to go the day before.
Well,
they had barricades.
I do remember.
It's a whole big deal.
I had Sadie on my back. Or maybe you had Sadie on your back when it got bigger, right? I would have Granger on my back.
When the parade got bigger.
When the parade got bigger.
Yeah, yeah. As opposed to...
When Sadie got bigger.
All right, yes. Well, whatever. Anyway, she was a marvelous person, an interesting person, enthusiastic person. She was the one who built up the parade, built up the fireworks,
right, yes.
Built up the Macy's Flower Show.
Yeah.
I mean, really put a tremendous amount of showmanship and energy. And she even did the Tap-O-Mania. Which I think Ellen Yokelson was in. You know, people from all over came.
I thought
to
it was
tap.
Beer.
Oh, in I know.
In front
I was getting
of Macy's. All right,
like a tapping flash mob kind of thing.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. So she seemed like a marvelous person. There's a great picture of her from just a few years ago, I enjoyed reading about her.
All right. So in any event, so now we get to the play.
And I thank her
because.
You know, it's fun having the Macy's Parade.
Yeah, no, it was good for the city. Events. So here's the way we covered My Fair Lady with our reporters out there. Not only did we have three of us, namely Sadie and Tamsin and myself, go to last night's marquee Saturday night performance of My Fair Lady, the Saturday night performance immediately after the Friday morning newspaper review. Talk about quick coverage. But we had, even before that, Dixon at the Saturday matinee performance, just to make sure there was consistency between performances.
So Line Court was really well represented.
Exactly. We had the whole
thing
covered.
Lincoln Center yesterday.
We had it covered like a blanket.
Yeah.
And Lincoln Center, of course, is a very impressive venue to do this.
So here's the deal. I was apprehensive, you know, because going to see revivals is tough, all right? Especially My Fair Lady, because you know every song.
Yeah.
You know every inflection.
Right.
In Rex Harrison's voice.
Right.
Okay? So there was that.
Well, but before we get to you, all right? Because I want to know what Dixon thought, because he saw it before we saw it.
I was going to say, Dixon, so do you have that level of familiarity with My Fair Lady?
Not as much as you guys do. I mean, I've watched My Fair Lady once, to be honest with you.
Once.
So I didn't really have too much of a comparison.
So you weren't singing along in the theater?
I knew some of the songs, but not all of them.
And you were with a bus group.
Correct.
From your work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so what was your reaction?
Overall, I thought it was really good. I don't know where my start here, but I just thought...
Wherever.
Lauren Ambrose, to me, was an odd choice. I picture her as in...
6 Feet Under?
6 Feet Under, which was one of my favorite shows of all time, actually.
Right. Yeah.
But so I couldn't kind of get through that.
Really?
Couldn't get your head around...
No, but I thought overall she surprised me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know she could sing, so I don't follow her, you know? So I just thought that was kind of a surprise to me, how good she sang.
Right.
But... I don't know if she was the best choice for that, but she did a very good job.
Okay. All right.
And
yeah.
Now so how would you compare that to, you recently went to Carousel, the revival Carousel.
Right.
So how would you compare your experience in the two?
I thought the acting and the singing in Carousel to me was a little bit better, but I didn't like the story. I didn't know anything about Carousel. Mm-hmm. I never saw it. I thought it was going to be like Sound of Music, so I was completely clueless.
Yes, right. And it's quite different from that.
It's very different. So the theme was very dark in Carousel.
Yeah.
But I like, you know, some of the singers a little bit better in Carousel.
And what was the buzz on the bus?
They liked. I mean, they were excited. I was with, like, you know, the older crowd. But they seemed to have a very good time.
Okay, they weren't all saying, oh, he wasn't as good as Rex, or...
No, I didn't hear
she
that.
She wasn't as good as...
See, that's an important thing. But let me ask Sadie what she thought first. Then we'll get to the next generation, the older generation, the greatest generation. We'll get that reaction. But first, we'll get Sadie's, not part of the greatest generation. What do you think?
So, I was similar to Mom in the sense that I have listened to the soundtrack many, 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 many times. So, I had certain expectations about how it should go. And I really had no... idea who was cast in it, and I just knew it wasn't like the big Broadway heavy hitters. And I also thought, you know, there aren't really any, sometimes there are types of Broadway actors, and I don't think that there are that many types right now that fit the role of Rex Harrison or the Julie Andrews part. So it made sense to me that they didn't cast like Broadway heavyweights, but at the same time, I was skeptical. There were a lot of emotions around the casting choices. A lot of emotions. But I thought they were pretty good. I thought the woman was a strong singer. And they made some different choices with some of the songs with the Henry Higgins part, which I didn't love just because I'm so used to Rex Harrison singing it. But though it sounded fine.
Yeah.
I thought he didn't have as strong of a voice as Rex Harrison did in the sense of just like projection and literal volume. And that kind of changed the personality of the character a little bit. But I actually liked the character that he put together. So. Sure.
Well, let me just give a little context. I know Tamsin's in the same way.
Well, before we go any further, I just want to mention who the people are.
Well, but let me go even half step back as to who the characters are, just quickly. Because not everybody knows My Fair Lady's story. It's a story of Henry Higgins, who's a professor of English, who takes on the project of educating a flower girl, Eliza, and he takes on a bet that he can educate her to speak proper English and behave properly and be passed off as a member of society, and the show becomes whether that experiment can succeed or not.
Flower girl meaning basically beggar.
Yes, she's a flower girl outside.
Not a professional,
she's
like,
trying to get
wedding,
money. You know,
exactly right. She's a street person.
Yeah. Street person.
She's a street person.
Okay.
Okay, and the casting is?
Lauren Ambrose as Eliza, Harry Haddon Patton as Henry Higgins, Norbert Leo Butts as Alfred Doolittle,
the father
Eliza's
of Eliza.
Dad,
yeah.
Diana Rigg as Henry
Eliza's
Higgins'
mother.
Mom,
yeah.
Alan Corduner as Dr. Pickering.
Oh, yes, of course.
And Jordan Donica.
As the love interest, the
Ansford
young guy.
Hill. Freddie Ansford Hill.
Freddie Ansford Hill, who
marries Freddie?
Frings the iconic song, On the Street Where You Live. The one song that becomes a popular song, as things often did as the musicals in those days. And My Fair Lady, of course, the... often called the perfect musical.
Right.
Certainly the iconic musical, mm-hmm. maybe the biggest musical of the 20th century. And we'll go back into the story of that in just a moment. And famously starring, and we're talking about comparisons with the stars, famously starring Julie Andrews.
In
18 years old in the part.
Well, no. She was 19, but she plays the part of an 18-year-old.
All right.
Yeah.
And as Eliza Doolittle. And we've said the name many times, Rex Harrison, as Professor Henry Higgins, famously somewhat older than Eliza Doolittle. And we'll get back to that age difference in just a second, because it's the kind of thing that's been debated many times in the play, and of course based on a play called Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. So Tamsin and I are very familiar with My Fair Lady. We've seen the movie, we've heard the score many times. So what was your reaction with that as a background, Tamsin?
As a background?
Yeah.
So my reaction was, it was fine.
Right.
It was fine. I said, I'm often nervous about revivals because I've seen some disappointing ones.
Right.
Like Sadie, I missed Rex Harrison.
Right.
There's something about, we'll talk about this more probably. I mean, it was based on a play by George Bernard Shaw. In my old age, I'm a big fan of George Bernard Shaw, of his language, his wit, and that to me
and his great playwright. He's a great playwright.
That to me very much came through in a much more compelling way with Rex Harrison's approach
songs. That's right. Well, that's a good
point. Lauren Ambrose was fine. Diana Rigg was adorable. She was hilarious.
Right, but it's not a big part.
No, it's not a big part, but she was fun.
Yeah.
Let me just say, the sets by Michael Yergin were unbelievable.
Were unbelievable.
Absolutely believable.
Absolutely. Oh, they will take that line from the play. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Really impressive.
Yeah. It was an amazing... Look, it's like when Lincoln Center does one of these things, they pour money into it like nobody's business. It's like no other production.
I don't care whether they did or they didn't.
It's fantastic.
It's
gorgeous.
They have a lot of space. Like the amount of space they used on the stage to move the sets back and forth. They obviously have a ton of space back.
Well, the turntable.
The turntable is
the size of our house.
Yeah.
That's the new trend, because every show I've seen
has a turntable
in the last like 2 years has had that big turntable.
Well, Hamilton has it, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the show we saw last year, Groundhog Day,
was
like their big shtick is having the turntable.
Yeah,
the one we saw over Christmas, which I'm forgetting.
Well, the initial production of My Fair Lady in the 60s had a turntable too.
Right.
So it's fair game. But, you know, just going back on the cast, I will say I thought Lauren Ambrose was really good, you know, and she didn't play it like Julie Andrews, but she was very effective and it was different. And I had no problem with that. And I thought she was very engaging. I thought Henry Haddon Patton was good too, but... couldn't get rid of the ghost of Rex Harrison. And I realized while I was watching it, we were discussing this on the drive home, that Rex Harrison was sort of above the material, in a sense. It was one of those performances, like we were talking about, Zero Mostel,
Robert Preston,
a few other folks, Nathan Lane even to some degree. You're saying he's playing this, but I know who that is. That's Nathan Lane. And he's sort of coasting above it.
But it's not even that, but he's larger than life.
Creates
the play.
And on top of thing, he had been known as a great, and we debated, Shavian actor. even before this. He had been in the straight
and
plays.
And during the rehearsals, he's actually referring back to Pygmalion.
And saying, what did the old man say about this? So he's acting George Bernard Shaw. He's not there as a singer. He's acting it. And he is so forcefully true to the material. And he's so in character. It carries you away. And this poor guy playing that part yesterday just couldn't possibly do that. So that element's missing. And the other thing is that you know all the jokes. It's a play that's so much about words. And, you know, Carousel, I understand it. I know you weren't familiar with it before, but obviously that's a revival too. When you see a revival like Carousel, it's the music. Mm-hmm. Okay? And the idea of hearing music again, certainly wonderful music like that that's orchestrated with a full orchestra, it doesn't really lose too much. It's the same experience. If the songs that we've heard in My Fair Lady 20, 30, 50, 60 times with the wordplay and the little jokes of this or that, is that going to have the same impact when you see it the 51st time? It just can't possibly.
Yeah, it's a tough sell. And, I mean, let me be a little bit self-indulgent and retell the story of how I first heard of My Fair Lady. Actually, when I was a little peanut, I was on the Pleasant View swim team.
Yeah.
In the winters, we sometimes had a winter practice.
Yeah.
And the indoor pool was somewhere far away from our house, and my father had to drive me there. And we're driving back home from practice once, and there was this broadcast of a Broadway show, and it was My Fair Lady. And I was listening to this, and I was blown away. The song's like, "Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man?" Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm like 6 or 7 years old. And I thought it was hilarious. I never heard people talk like that. We weren't a Broadway family or anything. And so my parents got me the album for Christmas or my birthday, whatever was around. And I just loved it. And then the next thing that happened, it actually turned out that there was a Hallmark Hall of Fame production of Pygmalion, the play that My Fair Lady is based on TV. Yeah. And I very clearly remember setting up with my TV tray table in front of the black and white in the living room in Kensington, Maryland. And turns out that was on TV when I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. So already at 9, I am dying to see Pygmalion. Well, and it was with Julie Harris. And I loved that.
Right.
And for some reason.
But we all grew up with that.
It resonated.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we all had the chance to get, and I know Dixon bought it and we bought it too, at Lincoln Center, they often have a more complete program of materials.
Like a souvenir brochure.
Right, but it's quite substantive. They it has like 6 or 7 great articles in it.
It's got great articles, and you get it for free, but they like you to give a dollar donation.
Right, so it, first of all, it tells you, number one, it has a great article about George Bernard Shaw and his feeling about what he was doing and what he felt about Pygmalion becoming a musical. And people approached him about it becoming a musical and becoming a movie property. First, it's a very true story about how it became a movie property. The movie Pygmalion, 1938, Leslie Howard, Wendy Hiller. If you haven't seen it, a great movie. This is non-musical. This is Pygmalion. Great movie.
And Shaw was involved.
Shaw was involved.
He did writing for it.
Right. Yeah. But this strange fellow talked him into it. That story's in there. Just amazing. But it's a great, great film. And they superimposed a different ending on it, which Shaw was able to accept. And the ending's an issue. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then, of course, there's a question, would it be a musical? And Shaw's feeling was, should not be a musical because...
Well, this is interesting because you can see him shying away from, but it's my play. It's a serious, it's a real play. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get it dumbed down with, you know, song and dance. But it wasn't just that. Mm-hmm. It was economics, okay? Once he had another play that was produced as a musical.
Right, became The Chocolate Soldier.
And once it's out there as a musical, everybody who wants to put it on wants to put on the musical, not the play.
So he doesn't get the residuals for the straight play.
So he loses money. And he said, Pygmalion is my biggest moneymaker.
That's right.
I'm not giving that away.
So in any event, of course, he passes at a certain point. He dies in 1950 at the age of 90-something. And then the property gets passed along, and it gets in, because a lot of people think it's a great play, it should be a musical. It gets
and
in the hands.
Tried.
Well, it gets in the hands of Rodgers and Hammerstein, right? Who wrote Carousel. Mm-hmm. And Rodgers and Hammerstein work on it for a year, and they can't do it. And the reason they can't do it is it's a drawing room play. As originally constructed, it all takes place in a drawing room. They're sitting there teaching Eliza how to talk. Mm-hmm. And they give up. And the property goes out into public domain, and it's picked up by Lerner and Lowe.
Well, it's got other problems. There's nowhere to have, there's no clever places to put a dance number.
Right. Well, I mean, that's because it's drawing room comedy.
It's written so tightly.
Right. It's written, you know? That's, it's written tightly. You can't do anything with it. It's written so perfectly.
And there's no love story.
Well, or is
a
there?
Musical, or, an American
or,
musical
or
has
Or is there a love story? That's what you have to figure out. Okay?
No, there isn't. And it gets imposed on it.
Well, that will, look, they have to solve the problem. So it goes to Lerner and Lowe. And there's some wonderful material about Lerner and Lowe who are weird in their own right. Lerner and Lowe wrote some great musicals. In particular, they wrote Gigi. And at that point, they had written Brigadoon. But they had their own issues. And you know, Lerner was kind of a nutty guy. And he actually, more than a nutty guy, he had a drug problem, he had an alcohol problem, but a brilliant guy. The older guy was Frederick Lowe. Unlike Lerner, who was American, Frederick Lowe being Austrian. And he was a little more classical music oriented. They were an odd coupling. But they get a hold of this property after being split before then. And this becomes the property upon they get back
together.
Well,
they work on it for a while and it kind of drives them apart.
Right.
But the interesting thing is that Lerner has figured it out. He even talks to Hammerstein at a certain point. And Hammerstein says, you know, what are you working on? And he says, Pygmalion, you know. And Hammerstein says, well, that's too bad.
Right.
Dick and I couldn't do it. Who can do it? And Lerner says, I figured it out. They're trying to write a musical. They're trying to write songs for someone like Alfred Drake.
Right.
You know, the big singer.
Right.
You can't do that. You have to have someone like Rex Harrison.
And it literally says Rex Harrison before he's cast in the play.
In your mind.
Because he's a well-known actor.
This.
Right.
It's got to be that kind of thing.
So then they do write it together, and they have some wonderful stories about the fact that Frederick Lowe always wrote the music in his underwear. We won't go into that too much. Or the fact that he was living next door for the purpose of this project from Lerner and his wife, and sometimes he would just come by in the middle of the night or sometimes while they were sleeping.
Mrs. Lerner would wake up.
And he'd be sitting in
their
bedroom.
The corner, and he says,
I got a new song.
I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're awake.
I'm glad you're awake. I have a new song. All right. So they were obsessed with this.
And she did have that great story about at one point, the guys come and drag her out. There's a blizzard going on.
Right.
They drag her out of the house, into the blizzard, across to the studio. They want to play something for her. And they act it out. And it's the Rain in Spain number. And she goes, and she's completely overwhelmed. She says, you have one problem.
Okay.
This is going to completely stop the show.
Right.
And of course, when they perform it, it does.
Yes, and it did the opening night. And then the stories more, they have special stories about how it opened and how difficult it was to get Rex Harrison to get comfortable with it, how anxious he was, how nervous he was, how nervous Julie Andrews was because she felt that, you know, she was very young. And
she was just a kid. And here we have Rex Harrison, actor.
Right, and the solution was Moss Hart, who was this great director who managed to somehow bring it all together. They finally get to opening night, and it is the smash of all possible smashes.
Moss Hart, who also had a house in Bucks County.
Oh. Right. And the program actually, so the question, it gets down a little bit to sexual politics, as all the revivals do now, because the question is it a love story? And the troublesome thing about that has always been that, as played by Rex Harrison, the Henry Higgins part, much older than the young Flower Girl. The Flower Girl is 18, 19, 20. Rex Harrison, even at the time he was doing it, must have been 50, let's say, at least. And is that a love story? Could it possibly be a love story? It wasn't quite that. It wasn't quite clear in the play or the movie that you saw. They talked about it here. They felt that they addressed that by having a younger Henry Higgins. Although I won't tell what the ending is. They sort of addressed it in the new ending too, or they didn't, depending on how you interpret that. But it was on their minds. But I thought there was something interesting in the program. Written, there are many well-known people in the theater writing about it, and this is a fellow named Michael Corey who wrote the lyrics for War Paint and for Grey Gardens. And he said, you know, here's the deal. The real story of My Fair Lady and the reason for our eternal fascination with it is the conflict between brain and heart. It's the story of how we define our lives to ourselves and how much we dislike having that story disrupted by someone else. That goes for both protagonists of the musical, and their journey of discovery is charted through a stunning and comparable series of solo song soliloquies. I've always been captivated by the tension beneath the cultivated surface of Edwardian manners and mores. Every time I hear a song, I have to stop what I'm doing and listen and marvel. I believe My Fair Lady will outlive the golden age of other musicals, because as long as people insist upon lying to themselves to avoid emotional entanglement, it will continue to fascinate us, amuse us, and shoot arrows into our hearts.
So despite her, you know, class limitations,
right,
she is every bit the match for Henry Higgins. And that's the beauty of it. I just want to make one more note, which is kind of fun, also in this brochure. This I had no idea about. It seems that the woman that Shaw based the Eliza character on,
yeah,
was partly reminiscent of Jane Morris, the wife of William Morris. Now, you know William Morris wallpaper, mm-hmm, and the kind of the floral designs. He was a craftsman. You know, some people feel sort of the whole instigator of that crafts movement in England and the U.S. In the 19th century. He's a socialist writer and campaigner. Shaw knew him, knew them, and Morris was from the upper class. He married this woman who was the daughter of a stable hand.
Oh.
And so, to some extent, she had some sort of training and coaching to be able to deal with her newfound status.
Well, that's kind of, and that's weird. Yeah.
So there's a nice story in the booklet from Lincoln Center about that and tracing her. Although they make it clear that in public or even in social situations, Mrs. Morris didn't talk at all.
Yeah.
So she was not trained to talk.
Well, that was a little bit.
But it was about that class disconnect that even existed then.
Well, there's clearly something compelling about that that almost goes beyond the romance. Look, again, get the program. They have, going back to your point about growing up and seeing it in a Hallmark Hall of Fame or having it been a huge part of your upbringing and being introduction to musicals, that's so universal. They have person after person here who's in the theater. They have Stephen Flaherty, who wrote Ragtime. They have his wife who helped him write the lyrics to Ragtime. They have Ben Pasek and Justin Paul, who of course wrote Dear Evan Hansen and La La Land.
David Yazbek.
Yeah, and then they have David Yazbek writing a piece, how much it influenced him. It's just unbelievable. But my favorite story of all these was one, and this is also like your story, Tamsin, and this a woman named Kristen Childs, who wrote the music and lyrics for Bubbly Black Girl, Sheds Her Chameleon Skin. And she says, well, what she remembers it being in school in her music class, she had a woman named Miss Dale. She would clasp her hands and pound them against her gut as she commanded us to clutch our diaphragms and sing with gusto. And just like little adenoidal nightingales, we clutched our diaphragms, stretched our necks, and sang with great theatricality. Oh, what a towering feeling just to know somehow you were near. So I'm sure Miss Dale probably had her moments of wincing, but she never gave up lecturing, and damned if from time to time we didn't cause enchantment to pour and have every door. So there you go. So
we're going to leave you with a version of that.
Of that very song. And I think we all give thumbs up to My Fair Lady, although with different cautionary notes, depending on your familiarity with the material. And
that song is sung by
Nat King
Jordan
Cole.
Danica in the play.
And he's great.
Terrific.
That is the best version I've ever seen of that song in that show.
But Sadie has come up with a darn good version from Nat King Cole.
And that's what we'll leave you with. And until
so
next
this is
week,
Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. See you next week.
I have often walked down the street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you live. Are there lilac trees in the heart of town? Can you hear a lark in any other part of town? Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just
laugh on the street where you live. And oh, the towering feeling just to know somehow you are near. The overpowering feeling that any second you may suddenly appear.